Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSR HealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence, the show that explores the possibility that ancient civilizations may have been correct in their belief that history moves in a great cycle with high ages of enlightenment and low ages of darkness. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with my co-host Jeff Patino. We both work at the Binary Research Institute, which is an archaeoastronomy think tank. And it's there that we explore the possibility that the a rise and fall of civilization that we see in the archaeological record might actually be due to our sun's motion that carries the Earth with it around another star. And this this binary theory is becoming a little more popular. Matter of fact, there's some well-known mainstream scientists that are now looking for a possible companion to our sun, including Richard Muller at UC Berkeley, Whitmire and Matisse at the University of Louisiana, and a few others. We have today a special guest with us who is actually going to talk indirectly about this subject. As stated, we believe this rise and fall of civilization, this great cycle of history that Plato called the Great Year, is due to this celestial motion that produced the observable of the precession of the equinox. But it doesn't, people often say, okay, well, what about this motion would actually cause the rise and fall of civilization? And that gets a little bit technical, but our guest today will be addressing some of those issues.
And our guest today is physicist John Daring. And John is really, he's one of the most interesting people that I've ever spoken to, and every conversation I've had with him has always just been fascinating on a number of levels. And like you said, Walter, he will get into the kind of the science behind the mythology of the Great Year.
Yes, John is not only a physicist, but I've known him on a personal level for a number of years, and he is one who has studied ancient cultures and more of the esoteric sides of scientists of science. So by day, while he's working in the norms of science, physics, by night he is this this prowler who really explores some of the more interesting and esoteric areas of science. And as our regular listeners know, that's really what we're trying to bring out here, that there is a connection between ancient cultures and modern science, and that ancient cultures really weren't just these primitive cavemen. A matter of fact, you know, when we look at some of the evidence from ancient Sumeria, Akkad, Babylon, where we find the Babylon Battery, Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, where we find, you know, very complex cities. Even ancient Egypt, you know, with the Great Pyramid that is so precisely built and aligned, and then all those all that talent seems to go away as we move into the Great Dark Ages before reemerging in the Renaissance. And so we're using modern science to try to explore what that is all about.
Yeah, and I'd also like to mention that John will be one of the featured presenters at the upcoming conference on precession and ancient knowledge in October at UCI. So if you're listening to the show today and you find what John says to be as fascinating as we do, then you can hear even more from him at the conference, and you can find out more about CPAC 2006 at the website cpaconline.com.
Well, as long as you mention it, let me just tell our listeners who some of the other presenters will be at this year's conference. One is Graham Hancock. He is a well-known explorer and author, famous for writing Fingerprints of the Gods, a book that sold over 5 million copies. And it really chronicles his travels around the world, finding evidence of ancient cities and his effort to try to postulate why they disappeared. Another very interesting speaker we have for the first time with us this year is Jeff Marcy, and Jeff is...
He's one of the foremost astronomers in the world. He is actually the guy who figured out how to find planets around other stars back in the early 90s and really pioneered that effort, and to this day has found more planets around extrasolar planets than any other astronomer in the world, and we're thrilled that he's going to be presenting at the conference.
Yes, he's the head of astronomy at UC Berkeley, so we're delighted to have him. Anyway, we're going to need to take a short break here, and you are listening to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cretton with co-host Jeff Patino, and we will be back shortly with our special guest, physicist John Daring.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Patino. And we have our special guest today, physicist John Daring. John works at CERA, which is a local company here in Southern California. I believe, John, what's CERA stand for again?
CERA is a acronym for Scientific Applications and Research Associates.
And you've worked there roughly how many years?
Well, actually, I'm one of the founding employees going back to 1989 when it was primarily just discussions among a group of people across the coffee table. The company really didn't get off the ground, meaning that we were able to pay each other salaries until around 1992.
Well, we're going to tell our listeners a little bit about your background there, just so they know what they're getting into, and you just correct us here if we're wrong.
Sure. Well, John, we know you've got over 25 years' experience in the analysis, design, and testing of advanced systems dealing with the generation and detection of optical, electromagnetic, and acoustic wave energy. Actually, I'm just going to go ahead. Your bio is so interesting. I'm just going to straight read it off the paper here. Mr. Daring has applied his expertise in the development of sources of intense beams and fields. John's contributions to directed energy systems include the development of advanced high-energy gas lasers, optically pumped lasers, and applications of nonlinear optics. His directed energy experience also includes free electron and nuclear pumped lasers and systems for charged and neutral particle beam technology. In addition, he has developed novel methods and sources for generating intense electromagnetic fields in the very low frequency. Mr. Daring has also pursued analysis and experimental verification of methods for guiding electromagnetic energy through various portions of the Earth's geophysical environment. Mr. Daring became intrigued by reports that certain electromagnetic field conditions have significant effects on the human mind and body and other biological systems. And John is presently performing analysis of how a binary orbit model of precession could produce an interaction between the electromagnetic field from a distant stellar object and the Earth's electrical resonances, and how this might be the mechanism that drives the rise and fall of civilization. Building on his investigations into potential methods of wireless power distribution, John has started analysis of how some ancient sites and features may have served as a system for global communication and power transmission. Wow, that's John. You have one of those, I think, jobs and positions in research that most people fantasize about and don't really even know exist.
How'd you get into it in the first place, John?
Well, let's see, I guess we could go back to the very beginning, but to probably give a little bit more direct answer to that, the work that I've been involved in, as you noted correctly, for the last 25 years or so, is in directed energy. And that certainly has been a very lucrative area for people to pursue, but starting, I guess, in the late 1980s, I began to realize that there were areas that were not being explored that we could probably begin to open up. For example, high-intensity acoustics, at that point, was largely an unexplored area in the physics or applied physics or engineering community. Very, very limited work had been done there. And frankly, the way that I was able to come up with that kind of a job description was, frankly, we created it. We put a company together, and the company's been very successful. We are now, you know, in the multi-million dollars a year. We have a variety of different customers, both within the U.S. government and also from private industry. And we are doing work that has ranges all the places from advanced digital signal processing on the one extreme to the areas that I tend to be more involved with, which are the generation, handling, and transmission of energy. Sometimes the generation is the area of focus, such as new sources of energy, new sources of power, some work going on right now in renewable energy. And in other areas, I'm also working on how you then take and concentrate or project that energy, typically in the form of a beam or in some other mode that does not require a physical connection between the sender and receiver. And, of course, there are all of the usual applications for that, which range from things in the transmission of power for constructive purposes, as well as those that might be connected more with defense areas.
Well, John, you certainly know more about subtle energy than just about anybody I've met. How did that start to combine with interest in ancient cultures or ancient technology? I think you even mentioned that some of your customers had an interest in studying possible ancient energy technology.
Well, yeah, let me kind of take a step back from that and tell you that over the years, when involvement both at CERA and in places that I had worked prior to that, such as TRW and then before that Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, from time to time I would run into other physicists who, during our sort of informal discussions, occasionally it would get around to the topic of ancient civilizations. And oftentimes what I found was that, like myself, there was a rather strong suspicion on the part of a number of I would describe as the more open-minded, inquisitive sort of individuals, that something had been going on in ancient times that involved the use of a type of power that simply could not be accounted for by the typical explanations that come to us through anthropology and the historians who describe, for example, let's take the case, the obvious one, of how did they move the immense stone blocks at some of the megalithic sites. The question was posed more than once by colleagues of mine, many of whom had interests that were very mainstream, but essentially had done enough of a back-of-an-envelope calculation to begin to realize that this probably could not be done with human power or animal power. It wasn't the question of how many people could have been applied to the job, but the quality of the work, the finesse, and the time required indicated that some other method of power had been used. In my own case, I'd always had a suspicion that there had been advanced civilizations on Earth before, but I think one of the first eye-openers for me was, in fact, at CERA, as a result of my work in high-power acoustics, I was spending a great deal of time thinking about the type of, you might say, objects or surfaces or shapes that are used to transform or focus or channel sound waves. Now, they're all, ultimately, wave energy is wave energy. There are certain basic principles that waves all have to follow, but acoustics is particularly interesting because the scale of the wavelength is on the order of the size of the human body and a little bit larger, tens, tens of times the dimension of human beings. And it began to look at some of the ancient structures around the world, the ancient sites. And what had occurred to me was how, in many cases, if it was a coincidence, it was remarkable, there appeared to be deliberate engineering in those structures showing that whoever had built them had a rather sophisticated, and in fact, I might add, very sophisticated knowledge of wave physics. It's one thing to simply set up a wall or even a curved surface because you've noted that sound waves are reflected and you can do something with the echo. That I would describe as more of a fortuitous observation. What I'm referring to is different. There were features in buildings such as the citadel of Chichen Itza that clearly showed that whoever had put that together had some understanding that sound is a wave phenomena with a particular wavelength and a particular frequency.
Well, what's an example of one of those features in it?
Well, if you look at the citadel, there are a number of them, and some of them are subtle. And I'll try to explain this in a way that'll keep it interesting, because, of course, to a physicist, I could throw a few terms out that would sum this up pretty quickly. In fact, the term would be, it is a diffractive structure. But let me explain what I mean by that. Sound waves undergo reflection, or they can be bent through what's called refraction, which is something like a lens. But they also have a type of a behavior that's known as diffraction, which is what happens when they encounter an edge or a sharp boundary or a surface, in this case, that has a periodic structure to it. For example, something that is regular. Now, that in itself doesn't indicate any understanding of sound waves. But in looking at the citadel, what you will notice is it is the spacing and the scale of those, combined with the fact that at the citadel there is a well-known feature that if an individual stands at a particular location and claps their hands together, the sound that comes back from that echo is not the short impulse sound of the hands clapping together, but it has been dispersed. It has actually been transformed, somewhat similar to the way light would hit one of those prismatic gratings that we sometimes see, or the effect you get when you look at a CD or DVD disc and you let intense light shine on it and you see the rainbow colors. Well, similar type of thing happens, except in this case at the citadel, many people have found it quite interesting that the sound that comes back actually resembles the cry of a particular bird in the jungle.
I've heard that tourists go there particularly to do this, clap their hands, and you can hear the bird sound.
My friend Nicole Jones, who's also is doing a lot of work in researching this area and is herself a very gifted author, has gone down there and produced a short videotape of her doing this, and it's rather eerie. But of particular note, though, is that's a kind of a cute parlor trick. You might say, okay, you know, why build an immense structure simply for the purpose that you could make a funny-sounding echo? But if you looked at it a little bit deeper, once that occurred to me that, oh, yes, the structure of the building is dispersing the sound, then I began to look at other features. And my opinion was immediately that, wait a second, there are other places in that building that also appear to have been intended to do similar or even different things to sound waves. So the question is, was that, shall we say, the bird call effect, a marker or a come-on that was left there to indicate to people at a time when they would again regain the knowledge of sound physics that there is more embedded in that structure? For example, Jim Corum, who's a very good friend and colleague of mine and is in fact one of those physicists and engineers who's deeply interested in these ancient mysteries, he's wondered if perhaps there is information encoded in that structure somehow. It's a little bit reminiscent of the idea of putting information in a grooved pattern on a disc, for example, a phonograph or a optical CD. That's one speculation, but looking again at other ancient sites...
Just on that point real quickly,
yes.
How would one actually play that back? How would you decipher the information?
There are a number of possibilities. One is that perhaps one would do some type of a particular chant or rhythm that might have been passed down by oral tradition, that when those waves are illuminating the structure, what happens is they're coming back now in a transformed pattern with specific, shall we say, information now that has been picked out of them. In other words, it's a bit like this. It would be you shine a signal on there, and the structure now picks out those frequency components and reassembles them, which would have possibility of some meaning. It may not necessarily be a recorded voice message. It might have something more to do with either mathematics or perhaps astronomical information, something that might have been encoded in the form of numbers.
Well, speaking of encoding, it might be time to encode a commercial here. So just like to remind our listeners, you're listening to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Crittenden with co-host Jeff Pitino, and we have our John Daring, and he'll be right back.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Crittenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, the same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Crittenden with Jeff Pitino and our special guest today, John Daring. He's a physicist at CERA. And John, I think you were just talking about the acoustic ability of the ancients.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating that, I mean, if you look at the Quetzal Temple and when you clap your hands, it comes back as the sound of the Quetzal bird. Just the fundamental understanding of acoustics that they had even to do that parallels, I think, what we know today. And to suggest that there's even more possibly hidden deeper in there, I find wholly fascinating.
Well, it is fascinating, and that's just one structure. I'm wondering, John, have you looked at other structures and see similar characteristics for either acoustic or other waveforms?
Well, acoustics is, of course, fascinating because it's the dominant mode that we communicate, but that then raised the issue, exactly as you have asked, well, what about other structures? The but also what about other types of wave energy? And, of course, electromagnetism exists as waves and fields. And stone, of course, is a medium that is, as all material is, it has electromagnetic properties. Now, in looking around the world, of course, we saw that there were many pyramids. There were many structures which exhibited periodicity. There were many structures which had chambers or passageways which appeared to have been set up to deliberately trap or guide wave energy or to suppress particular frequency components and allow others to exist or to reinforce themselves.
Well, let me just interject, too. I was reading an article the other day that mentioned that virtually all megalithic structures, cairns, tombs, pyramids, ziggurats, etc., before the year about 1500 BC, appear to be aligned with the cardinal points or the solstices, or in some cases a certain star. And then after about 1000 BC, 500 BC, you see that this this ability is going away. They're not only not building many of these structures, but the tombs that you do find tend to be haphazardly arranged, and it's just that magical ability just seems to go away. Does that play into this at all?
Well, I think that's a fascinating aspect of this, because the understanding, the type of engineering, first of all, just looking at the massive blocks that are involved, let alone the indication that possibly some understanding of fields and waves was present, does decline and go away. Certainly this does not show up, for example, in the Roman or Greek architecture, which is very impressive in its own regards, but this is a very different thing we're talking about here. This is not simply an appreciation for symmetry or, you know, the golden mean or the sort of things which we typically find to be aesthetically pleasing or to have some particular, if one will, artistic or even religious significance in terms of the dimensions and proportions. It appears as though at a time roughly before 1000 BC, and it increases as one goes back to the extent that we have sites that are well preserved from those earlier times, that it was exactly as you say, it was normal. It was part of the procedure for building to carefully align to either, you know, astronomical or the cardinal points. Geomagnetic points have also been discussed sometimes, as well as stellar objects. And this, of course, then raises the question, well, perhaps if they were incorporating into these structures the ability to, shall we say, trap or guide or at least respond to some type of a frequency or electromagnetic energy that was coming in, was it possible that this was being done in regards to a distant object, something that might, for example, be a star or some other energetic source in the sky, and that it was an awareness, for example, of an energy that was perhaps very subtle, and that might just be interpreted to mean very weak or very faint, as one would expect signals would be, but nevertheless somehow important for the functioning, or at least of considered to be of great significance, important enough that either for a reverential purpose or because it was actually practical and it was important to do so for some particular beneficial reason, health or whatever, the structures were aligned with regard to that object, or really, you might say, aligned with regard to some type of force or energy that that object was the source of.
Well,
the Great Pyramid, if one looks at it electromagnetically, does not simply appear to be, I mean, it's certainly a magnificent structure, but looking at it from an electrical engineering standpoint, it's quite interesting. The pyramid, and in fact other pyramids, even earthen mounds, the cairns, the stone temples in some locations, and the stone towers, they actually act like a certain type of an antenna. Now, some people may be rolling their eyes and saying that, well, obviously, any sort of object which projects itself above the surface of the Earth is going to have some features like that, but it goes far beyond that. The Great Pyramid actually has an electrical impedance match for the conductivity of the rock and soil around it. It appears as though when it was built, it was intended that it has a, you might say, a voltage maximum. In other words, there's a voltage that increases as one rises up through the structure to the very top of the pinnacle. And the current up there, the electric current, correspondingly drops off to zero. And as one goes to the base of the pyramid, the voltage or potential begins to drop and the current reaches its maximum. Well, that type of sort of inverse where the current is a maximum on one end and the voltage is on the other is what's known as a quarter wavelength structure, which is a feature of radio engineering. Now, this is a rather bold assertion. One would have to go in and look at this a little bit more in more detail than we would have time to discuss here, because within the pyramid, the chambers themselves, we did an accurate, very accurate computer model of the passages down to as fine a detail as they've ever been measured in any of the surveys. And we found that they actually acted as an acoustic resonator. But they discriminated out frequencies that you might say wouldn't have been of interest. But they permitted the chambers to oscillate at frequencies which were associated with the natural electromagnetic pulsations of our planet.
Well, to cut to the chase, for what purpose would they be doing this, John? And your, what's your best guess, anyway?
Well, this is going a bit out on a limb, but we've talked about the Great Year, this concept that there's a cyclical rise and fall to civilization. This is my own speculation, but I believe that in the case of some of these structures, this may have been the type of thing that was going on. If we are looking at a process where this orbital motion that our own sun goes through with its companion star, what if that motion was to periodically bring us closer towards another stellar object, some type of source of electromagnetic power, something that actually might have a strong enough field about it to cause an influence on living organisms, humans included, on this planet, at least over, you know, the duration of thousands of years as we're slowly approaching it.
As we're slowly approaching it.
Right. Our commercial break, we're going to go to break, John, but we're going to get back into this because I think we're really getting into the meat of electromagnetism and what knowledge the ancients might have had in relation to the Great Year. So we'll get back to that. I'd just like to mention really quickly, if at any point you want more information on the subjects we're talking about, please visit us at our website, which is www.loststarbook.com, where you can find out more about the theory of the Great Year and more about Walter's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence with Walter Cruttenden. I'm Jeff Pitino, and we'll be right back.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
What does HealthyLife.net and Amazon.com have in common? Well, they're both available on the internet. They both give great value. But most important, most of our positive program hosts and guests are accomplished authors, and their books are available from, you got it, Amazon.com. Now, it even gets better than that, because when you're listening on air to a HealthyLife.net host or guest, you can go directly to Amazon.com, and you can order your book while you're still listening to your favorite HealthyLife.net program. So when you hear an author you like, go to the homepage of HealthyLife.net and click on Amazon.com.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
ByRegion.net is the largest healing arts directory on the web. Our visitors are looking for holistic practitioners, schools, events, healing services, and products. Are you in healing arts? Become a member of ByRegion.net and get the best advertising values. You can increase your client base and your traffic. If you have a website, we can bring you more traffic. Want a website? Get a beautiful web display for only $4 a month. Become a member now. Mention HealthyLife.net and get 6 months free. Visit www.byregion.net or call 828-232-0016.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Hi, and welcome back to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden, and today we're talking with physicist John Daring. John, let's get right back into it and start talking about the pyramids when we left off, and the types of energy that they might have been trying to focus, and why they might have been trying to focus that, and what influence it might have.
Well, we know, for example, that it's a natural human response to adjust our buildings. In fact, you might say, we try to adjust our environment to respond to changes in the seasons. So, you know, I mean, it's having grown up myself in a colder climate, as winter approached, there were certain precautions, certain measures that one would take. They were of a practical nature. It isn't just that we like to keep warm. It actually becomes more important than that. And one of those is that since we're getting less solar energy, we try to do whatever we can to trap or maximize the little bit of warmth that we are getting from the sun. There are methods known as passive solar, things of that sort. Well, the model of the Great Year that you and I and Walter have talked about is this concept that our sun, being in a binary star system, of course, has got motion, therefore, towards and away from another stellar object, or at least a region in the sky that might act as a source of some field that has an influence over life here. So we can begin to speculate that over time, as we approach this object, that might account for the increase in brain activity and human civilization. But the question would be, and this may play into the existence of these ancient structures and sites, what happens on the downside of the cycle when we're receding away? This would be equivalent in some ways to winter, sort of the long winter. And as we are receding, the question might have been, at a time when people still had enough understanding to recognize what was going on clearly, how might they have responded to that? Again, assuming that at this time they would have been in possession of engineering skills, which frankly we might not even have now.
Well, let me just interject too. Bits of myth and folklore from cultures all over the world that they were not only aware of this cycle, but they tracked it and knew where they were in the cycle. For example, Stefan Mall, the foremost Assyrianologist who recently spoke at Stanford, was pointing out his fascination that so many of these cuneiform texts always are referring to the past as the future, as this really happy time that would once come again, and yet they were dreading their immediate future because they knew they were in this down cycle. So, yeah, it does make sense that if they all knew this, and I believe it's over 30 ancient cultures, according to Giorgio de Santayana, the former professor of history of science at MIT and the author of Hamlet's Mill, then you would have expected that they would take some precautions. So are you implying that the structures or something in the structures then in some way helps to magnify whatever influence the Earth is losing as it's moving through its binary orbit?
Yes, think of it this way. If we have some cosmic influence from a distant object that we're periodically closer to and then periodically also, unfortunately, moving further away from, during the time that we're moving away from it, the response might be to try to find ways to offset that effect. And again, this I'm assuming, would be at a time when the level of civilization would still be such that people could mount a coherent and organized effort and do so harmoniously rather than probably arguing about it the way we would in our present world. And one response to this might be that, okay, well, if we're moving away from this stellar source of energy, we might try to find means to increase it, to increase the amount that we're capturing. It might not have been possible to do that for the whole planet, but a pretty good second approach would have been to build structures that at least locally or regionally might have intensified or trapped or made it a little bit more favorable for that influence to remain there. An example of this type of thing would be the following. If one was, for example, to be approaching winter, we could argue that perhaps one way to increase the warmth, of course, would be to design our structures, our buildings, so that whatever sunlight was still available would be the most efficiently used. Now, let me not confuse people. When I'm only using sunlight here as an example to as a type of energy that we all understand and have experience with, the type of energy we're talking about here may be something that we're not fully would be able to recognize yet. This stellar object, of course, is not a source of light and warmth that we're talking about. It's a source of a field which has an impact on the functioning of the human brain and the human anatomy, the body, our health, perhaps regulates even those processes to an extent in animals and plants. And as the Earth recedes from it, there's going to begin to be a decrease, a decline in the quality of life simply because our source, our master clock for our computer systems, our brain, is beginning to recede from us, or we're beginning to recede from it. So we would find ways of building antennas, devices, you might say, that would be there for collecting and harvesting as much of that remaining signal as they could get and locally amplifying it. Perhaps the reason that so many of these great megalithic sites look similar and in fact appear to be aligned with each other on these interesting, you know, patterns, so there's some controversy over that, but there are some alignments that I think probably look quite realistic, alignments in this case meaning from site to site over large distances. Perhaps the intent was to set up a global network of these facilities, you might say, just as we can put together a bunch of radio telescopes on different parts of the Earth that collectively act to trap as much of a signal as possible.
John, just I'm going to hold your thought right there. Speaking of global networks, the global network of HealthyLife.net has to also have an opportunity to get a break in here. So you are listening to Cosmic Influence, Walter Crutton and Jeff Pitino, and we'll be right back with our guest, John Daring.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Crittenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time in a bookstore near you.
In college, I took a lot of history and liberal arts classes, and frankly, I don't remember much of any of it. But as an adult, I find myself engrossed in fascinating programs on the A&E and History Channel. They've pretty much helped me to be pretty impressive at social functions, and I just found out today that I can purchase DVDs of my favorite A&E and History Channel programs right through HealthyLife.net. You should visit HealthyLife.net and order your favorite A&E and History Channel program DVDs as well, and then discover how many people you can impress during your next social occasion.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with co-host Jeff Pitino and our special guest today, physicist John Dehring. And John has been talking about how ancient structures may have been built to sort of hang on to the positive effects of another stellar object that influences Earth during the higher ages. And I know to some this might sound a little woo-woo, but there's a tremendous amount of research that's been done to show how electromagnetic fields and subtle energies can affect human moods and human consciousness. One of those studies was done by Valerie Hunt at UCLA, which we talk about in our book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. And then there's also some interesting studies done and still ongoing on transcranial magnetic stimulation. And it's been found that TMS, basically a pulse magnet can to the brain, can affect performance very positively in some cases.
Yeah, and I mean, that's actually a very fascinating area of research because it really is in its infancy. It's only about 15 years old since it was really first applied at all, and it's still very crude, and we don't understand exactly why certain things happen, but it's becoming very well documented, even in journals like Science and Nature, that you can, both positively and negatively, depending on the type and frequency of electromagnetism, actually influence human mood and response time and reasoning and cognitive abilities.
Right, so the analogy here is if the sun is carrying the Earth around another star, and all stars are huge generators of subtle energies, then that other star or even a third object would have some effect on us. So, John, maybe you can just briefly describe this model, your hypothesis, and then we'll talk about what the ancients might have done specifically to keep this positive energy working for us.
Well, let's take a look at it. We have, first of all, the concept that our solar system, of course, which orbits about the sun, our sun is in a binary star system. This is something that I know your organization is currently doing a great deal of research looking at, as are a number of astronomers, a growing number, in fact. But that binary motion by itself doesn't necessarily have an impact on, for example, human brain structure or brain functioning. But the ancients, nevertheless, seem to talk about the cycle as if that was what was going on. I mean, they're pretty much referring to the fact that people are better, people act better, think better, think more, you might say almost in a more a divine way, for example, in these in these periods of enlightenment. The speculation I have is that there is in our interstellar environment somewhere, another object. Now, this object is presumably possibly a star, but if it is a star, it is one of these more exotic types that has with it an intense electromagnetic field, something of a, what was sometimes referred to as a high-energy astronomical object. And there are, of course, a variety of these phenomena. We've all heard terms such as black holes or neutron stars. There's a particularly interesting class known as a magnetar, which is a subclass of neutron stars, and it has this staggering magnetic field around it that can be on the order of 100 trillion times more intense than the Earth's magnetic field. Objects like that, and perhaps some that we're not really fully aware of yet, would be a source of such a field, so that as we come closer to this, we would find that progressively our planet, and therefore ourselves, would be immersed in a stronger and stronger field. The work that tends to support this hypothesis of mine is the fact that over about the last 15 years, if it's become acceptable in the last 15 years, there were certainly investigators who had noted this long before, but it's beginning to be a rather legitimate area now in science and medicine, sort of the crossover between physics, electrical engineering, and medicine and human anatomy, cellular mechanisms and genetics even, that our bodies actually respond very strongly to particular electromagnetic stimuli. Now, it's not true that we respond strongly to every type of electromagnetic field. That's actually not the case. We're rather inert, you might say, or uninterested to many of the fields that surround us. But at certain frequencies, meaning the field is changing at a particular rate or periodicity, you know, we all hear the terms like cycles per second. Well, at those frequencies and perhaps at particular intensities of the field, and then we can go into some more esoteric terms from physics with particular bandwidth and phase and rise time, we do find that the human brain will go very strongly into different modes of either brain rhythms will be set up, different patterns of thinking. We can, for example, cite the work at, Valerie Brown, for example, who's done this work.
Valerie Hunt, who's
done the work, for example, with the chamber that screens off all of the outside external electromagnetic influences, including those that are natural, those which are actually the planet itself, induced by our planet and the geophysical processes there. People in that chamber find that their ability to think clearly begins to deteriorate very rapidly, and yet there's nothing, you might say, wrong in that chamber. The air is fine, not a threatening environment, but it's simply the fact that it's devoid of these natural electromagnetic frequencies that our planet is resonating at 24 hours a day. As those fields are allowed to exist in there, they have normal behavior. This ability to, again, respond to normal cognitive tasks with a kind of a response rate or accuracy that one would associate with the individual from earlier test scores in a controlled environment returns. What's most remarkable is that in some instances, if the magnitude or intensity of those fields is increased beyond what the person normally experiences, they actually find themselves beginning to feel as if they're performing more clearly and accurately. They're having, you know, perhaps a feeling of euphoria. And, in fact, their test scores show that they're doing better.
Right. So Valerie Hunt then has shown that if people are separated from this field, their performance can deteriorate. And if we're attached to it, our performance is enhanced. So what about stone structures then, or the shape of the structures can enhance this field? What do you think the ancients knew or were trying to do then?
Well, what it appears they were trying to do was to set up structures that would respond as an antenna does. You know, when we build an antenna for radio waves, nowadays, because we tend to communicate on a lot of different frequencies, we try to make an antenna that receives anything. It's sort of like a sponge antenna. But in the early days of radio, people were a little bit more interested about building antennas that were precisely tuned to particular frequencies, because that was there were only one or two transmitters in those early days.
Right, John, we are precisely tuned to a particular frequency here, for better or for worse, and we're going to have to...
we're out of time.
...come back and really get into this. So if you don't mind, we'd like to have you back for another show. It's just... It's a fascinating subject, but one that is too long to really get into in depth right now. So I want to thank you, John, for being on this segment. Will you promise to come back?
Yes, I will.
Okay. You're listening to Cosmic Influence with Walter Crutton and Jeff Pitino, and we'll be right back.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Crutton with Jeff Pitino, and you've been listening to our special guest today, John Daring, a physicist with CERA. And he's been describing very briefly how some of these structures that the ancients built might have had a purpose, and that is to enhance the influence of the higher ages as we go through our binary orbit. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to really get into the details with him, so we are going to have him back sometime very soon. Jeff, I want to tell our listeners where they can get more information on this subject.
Yeah, just a reminder, if you'd like more information on the subject or more information on Walter's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, please visit our website, loststarbook.com.
And once again, I'd like to remind you, we have the CPAC conference coming up in October for those that really want to dive into this subject. And in addition to the guests we mentioned, as well as John, we will also be having Robert Schock joining us this year. He is the geologist that redated the Sphinx and just wrote a very interesting book called Pyramid Quest. We also have John Major Jenkins, one of the foremost Mayan cosmologists in the world, John Anthony West, a rebel Egyptologist, and several others, which I don't have time to get into right now. But we invite you to come to www.cpakonline.com and check out the conference, and hope you will join us. You've been listening to Cosmic Influence, and I'm Walter, and on behalf of myself and Jeff, bring on the higher ages.